Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eric, and with me is Ray.
Hello.
And here once again to bring you all things competitive in the world of Warhammer 40,000. We are just 2 weeks away from Las Vegas Open and the end to the ITC. There we go. I can't even enunciate today. I'm so excited. ITC season is what I'm trying to say. You'd think there wouldn't be any other news, but guess what? Games Workshop comes in and they've announced Gene Steeler Cult is coming out. The pre-orders should go up this Saturday, and they've already beckoned us with a huge list and data dump of new rules and all kinds of fun stuff, as well as for you Horse Heresy fans, a new model of one of the Primarchs. So not really sure if that will port over to 40K. Ray, what do you think of Sanguinius?
Well, he's dead in 40K. So
thank God. No, just kidding.
We're not going to see a model port over. I mean, even if for whatever reason they did decide to bring him back, which I think would kind of cheapen the whole story for the Blood Angels, we'd see a completely different model like they do with Gilliman.
I'd be curious. I've heard a lot of theories that they may promote either Mephiston or one of the other characters to that level.
I'm sure we'll see some good plastic characters for Blood Angels, but we're not going to see them turn like Primarch size. I guarantee we'll see Primaris for one or two of them, but we're not going to see them build it up to the scale of like a Primarch.
Probably not, but we'll see. But anyway, yeah, nice to see some new Primarch love for your 30K fans. But the big news of the day from Games Workshop is, of course, the Gene Steeler Cult preview. And as we kind of alluded to from our rumor section last week, we were, guess what? We were right on mark for once. So the new Gene Steeler Cult Ambush rules have changed dramatically, and some players are kind of reacting to it and strongly. Some are very negative. Surprise, surprise. I think it's something to give it a chance on the table. Although it's new to us, it is a old mechanic, as we alluded to in our previous rumor section, very similar to Space Hulk and some other games. But I liked how they made a couple changes because although it works really well in Space Hulk, I had some concerns how it would work on the 40K table.
Are you talking about the ambush?
Yeah. So before we get to the blip markers everybody's so upset about, let's talk about some of the other rules. Right at the bat, unquestioning loyalty is a lot more powerful than I think people give it credit for.
No, it's great. So basically, if a character fails a saving throw or suffers a mortal wound, as long as it's within 3 inches of a friendly Gene Steeler Cult unit, with the rule, you can roll a dice, and on a 4+, a model from that unit is slain, and the character remains unharmed.
Which, so very handy, yeah. Even if you've got the snipers and all the means to pick out characters, I got a security blanket in place.
No kidding. Keep a unit of neophytes right there, and you might as well have 10 extra wounds on your character.
Well, I thought it was interesting because normally you have to always be the unit has to be the closer target than the character. So then it becomes this kind of maneuvering of who can circle around the back, and that's one of the reasons I think flyers are so prevalent in a couple lists. Not like hordes of them, but everybody has like one or two for that sole reason. If I can get around the back, I can pick off the character. Now it's like, as long as I'm in 3 inches, I don't care. You know, 4+.
Yeah. And it's kind of neat under that, that they give that stratagem right after the hypermetabolism.
Yeah, talk just a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so just in case your character does get hit and manages to survive, at the start of your movement phase for 1 CP, you can use this stratagem and that character regains D3 lost wounds.
Which is kind of nice, because if you roll 4+ saves like I do, your character is going to be taking quite a few of those. So they're like, oh, well. So your opponent's like, aha, your dice are cold again. I'm like, yeah, but I got a command point. And it seems like Gene Sealer Cult's going to have a fair amount of command points available to them. So they not, maybe not as many as Orcs and Guard, but definitely more than, say, Eldari or some of the more elite armies. So,
yeah, they may not be as easy to populate a battalion as Orcs or Guard. I haven't actually tried, but they're pretty close. So I wouldn't be surprised if a 3-battalion army is doable. It'd probably be pretty likely.
Probably. So, yeah, we haven't seen any new updated point values yet. So I'll be curious to see how that all breaks out. So one of the other rumors, one of the things we saw already and some of the things we were all upset about when Chapter approved was, wait a minute, what about Cult Ambush and all the restrictions that can only be in your, after turn one and all that. And so far, the setting up underground rule is pretty much the same thing. It's a deep strike. You emerge on the battlefield more than 9 inches away from the enemy model. So I was like, okay, big deal, right? And then you scroll down a little bit and you go, well, hold on a second. Let's talk about the ambush. And these are the little blip markers. So first of all, the counters look pretty cool.
Well, I'll tell you this too. They're going to come, you're going to get 28 for free with your codex.
28? That's how many you're getting?
That's what it says on the, in the article.
Holy cow. Oh yeah, there it is. First 28.
Sentence, yeah.
So the way these things work is during deployment, you put these down as they represent a unit. And like I said, this mechanic's been around forever. Like old Avalon Hill games had this mechanic for a long time. But having played against those, I was a little concerned because there's always like goofy things like, well, how much is under the blip? And other games I've played where you could move the blips and how far could they move? And it was almost too much. I think they've done a nice job of reeling this in. So what happens is you set up the blips. Now, seriously, nothing was more annoying than, oh, there's this blip. It's running around and you devote all your forces to it. And it turns out to be like a, fire marker cadre. I'm like, really? Well, what's that blip? It's a hammerhead. Ah! So, okay. Well, so yeah. You set them up. And that's it. You then, one for each unit that you still need to place. So it can be a transport filled with the aberrants. It could be a cult Lehman Russ, or it could be a single Magus. It doesn't matter. So each one of them gets one blip marker.
Yeah. It's going to be important to point this out real quick. Mm-hmm. Important to point it out. You have to do this in your deployment zone. Yeah, you can place a marker for each unit you choose to set up in this ambush.
Within your deployment zone.
This is the best part. You do not need to assign a blip to a unit. You can pick whichever one you want to go wherever.
Yeah, this is probably the secret sauce. This is by far, everybody's all upset about the decoys. We'll get to them in a second. In every other system I played in, it was a pain in the neck because they were numbered. So I had to decoy number one, and you had to write down on your list. And invariably, your opponent saw it. You know, oh, I know what that one is. You can mix. Yeah. But in this way, you can mix and match after you've seen your opponent deploy and decide where everything goes. So is the blip all the way forward the Lehman Russ, or is it the one in the back corner the Lehman Russ? Well, you can decide. So that's kind of nice. And there's also listed this for additional command point, you can spend that. You can do this once per game. And then you get up to, I believe it's 4 additional. Look at that. To place 4 additional markers.
Yeah, no, it's you place 4 for that unit instead of just 1. So you'll have 3 false blips and 1 real blip.
Pretty, pretty cool. So when do you reveal these? And I think this is where I think your rig gets bent out of shape, because originally, like I said, I've seen these in other games. And all of a sudden, the blips start moving around until you get to within a certain range. And I was like, oh, that can get really problematic real fast. So it's Ray's playing Gene Stealer Cult. I'm his opponent. If Ray has first turn, he reveals them on his first turn during the start of his movement phase. If I have first turn, Ray can wait until the end of my movement phase to reveal these markers. And the best part is they're done one at a time. So he picks one, here goes over there, and then one goes over here. So he can basically, you're almost putting like placeholders, and then you deploy your army after your opponent has moved. I mean, that is a huge advantage.
Yeah. And if you're using these, your opponent cannot move a unit within 9 inches of one of these markers.
Which a lot of people are saying, oh, that's going to stifle my alpha strike, or that's going to... Yeah, it's kind of like how the alpha strike rebels that are hiding in the shadows. But being that you're... One of the other, like one player I saw, he was complaining that he felt like his army's going to be pinned in the corner by all these markers. And I'm going like, well, hold on a second. How is he going to do that if he has to deploy within his deployment zone? That doesn't make any sense. And then another player was like, my flyers will be restricted because they can't get within 9 inches of a marker. And I'm going like, again, he's in his deployment zone. There's at least 20 inches between your back edge and no man's land. So I was a little confused on some of the criticisms there.
Yeah, if you can't move the way you want to on a flyer first turn, that means you're not paying attention to what you're facing. You know, if you see Gene Stealer Cult, you should probably start with your flyer in the back anyway, just so you don't have to worry about something like that. Generally, flyers have enough range where even if they do that, it's going to be fine. In fact, your flyer might just do that much better for starting all the way back there.
I have, even playing the index version of this army, you know, deployment was essential. You know, a lot of that was, you know, not only what do you have up in the back, but you know, what did you have as a screen up front? So I don't think that much has really changed. But the fact that you don't know what you're screening against is probably going to be pretty huge.
And there's still more you can do with this. Yep. So you can actually, as they put it in here, change the nature of your ambush for one CP. You use the stratagem before you reveal an ambush marker, and you can select up to 3 units that are not vehicles from your army that are set up in the ambush. For each unit selected, you can remove one ambush marker from the battlefield, and the selected units are no longer set up in ambush and are instead set up underground.
So, quick version, that's all the thematic version, is that you spend one CP and you can remove 3 guys that were originally tokens, and then they go into deep strike. Again, after your opponent, either your movement phase or your opponent's movement phase. That's pretty powerful to see that. Oh, ooh, you're getting a little close to that. Let me take these away so you're now out in the wind, nowhere near anything. And by the way, these other markers, which are now out of charge range, happen to be my shootier units. And remember, it's just vehicles. You can still put some fast-moving models in underground as well. So that's like the new motocross bikes. So,
and then not long after that, we get another stratagem involving cult ambush. This one's 3 CP. This is used during the movement phase, right after you set up an infantry or a biker using the cult ambush ability. It can either move D6 inches, even if it just arrived as reinforcements, or you can shoot with all of its ranged weapons as if it was the shooting phase. The best part, this does not prevent it from shooting during the shooting phase or from making a charge during the charge phase.
On the surface, it looks really powerful because you get that extra shooting. I'm just trying to think of what are the shootier units in this army. I can't remember.
There's the Jackal Alpha that has a sniper. There is, I can't think of all the weapons that the Jackals themselves have. Those are, of course, the bikers. The Jackals are the bikers, for anybody who hasn't caught on. And since just about any vehicle can be set up with the Cult Ambush. So that includes the new one, which, while they have not released rules for yet, I am willing to bet that mortar-looking weapon you can put on it probably doesn't require a line of sight.
Hmm. Good point. I was just thinking like a large guard unit. You know, that pops up and I'm going to shoot twice. Because remember, you don't have access to, at least I don't think so. I don't care. Remember, you don't have access to orders. Actually, I'm not 100% sure of that.
No. Okay. No, you don't.
You don't. So it's almost like a little bit getting first rank fire, second rank fire back again. So.
Oh, yeah. And then there's the one unit. I can't remember what they call them, but it's basically the box of Astra Militarum Infantry that includes the heavy weapon team. So you have those guys pop up, which can have the mortar, if memory serves. I don't have the index in front of me.
Oh, yeah, forgot about those. Yeah, that's
going to be an army of deployment shenanigans, basically. But, I mean, that's kind of nothing new if you think about it.
Right. So you take all that into perspective for a second, and then remember the one thing they haven't brought up in this article, which they had brought up in a previous article, is the guy with the map. His special ability is he can move those blip markers somehow. I don't know whether it's before deployment or after deployment in the movement phase. My guess would be before the movement phase, but he has this ability to swap those around somehow. So now you've got even more misdirection. And I'm taking my marker and I'm moving it. And you're like, okay, what's under there? Well, I don't have to tell you until I deploy it.
That's... Yeah. It's called the Nexos.
That's a cool name. I like that. I don't think I ever knew that. It's pretty cool.
I don't remember where they put that. I know they posted it, but I can't seem to find it now myself. Yeah, they released the names for these guys today, too. The one that looks like an assassin, he's mm-hmm. called the Sanctus. The Voxcaster guy is called the Clamavis.
Nailed it.
There's the Locus, which I thought was something along the lines of a Magus, but apparently he's... They call him a bodyguard in the article, which is a little odd, considering he does not in any way look like a guard at all. You know, not one bit.
It's not protecting Whitney Houston?
No, not one bit.
Okay, so those who don't remember way back on beginning of the year, we talked about it on our January 5th show. So, unlikely pack of civilian revolutionaries. So, you have the Vox hacking technicians who are cunning and brute force to help you claim victory. So, a couple of the guys. So, yeah, there's the guy with the, what did you say his name was? A Narcos? A guy with the map? Nexos. That's what his name was. And yeah, they were kind of tight-lipped because they didn't want to give away the new ambush rules. But, yeah, he has the ability to move around the markers. So you have to be a little more clear exactly if that's prior to deployment or after deployment or it's a bonus move or what does that mean. So, but as we get more details on that, it should be pretty cool. And one other thing we were able to confirm when we talked about it is the outlaw guy that everybody loves.
The Colormorph.
In the kill team rules, he does come with 40K rules as well. And from what I could tell, he's ballistic skill 2. And if he kills a model, he can shoot again.
Yeah, and he's got 3 pistols to shoot with, so.
So he's pretty rough. And then the add back guy also has 40K rules, but I did not see exactly what that weapon does. It's looked like a conversion beamer type of thing. So we'll get some more details on that later date.
And then one of the, you know, pretty much everything's getting really set up for pre-order this weekend. You've got the Jackals. You've got all the characters. You've got the. Actually, I don't remember that new scout vehicle being listed. So that might be the weekend.
Achilles after. Ridge Runner.
Yeah.
Same thing with the terrain piece, the big drill. Don't know if that's coming out this week.
Yes. I don't remember seeing that on the list either. But you do have the, of course, the Codex this weekend. And this time around, they're having two different non-regular editions. We're going to see a limited edition like we've seen. And then we're also going to see a collector's edition. So they've already seen the price that leaked out for these. It's basically going to be exactly like the Space Marine one. You've got your normal edition, your a little bit more special edition, which I believe is considered the collector's edition, which has the special picture instead of the normal one that just goes around it. And then they've also got a limited edition, which is created to look like a defaced Imperial Army book. Not like a Facebook Imperial Army book. I mean, like something you'd expect a member of the Guard to be holding on him.
Oh, that's cool.
And each codex, it doesn't matter which one you got, is going to come with the little cardboard cutouts for the blips. And then, of course, you've got the cards coming out and dice.
It's pretty cool that they're kind of going all in on this kind of, I guess it would be, I'm going to call it fringe, but definitely not one of your mainstream codices. And you're kind of joking before recording. I wonder who it was in the boardroom and said, Gene Steeler Cult, that's going to be our new poster child for 2019.
Probably the same person who said they couldn't get it out before 2018.
Because I remember when they first came out, there was all this buzz, but it didn't seem like they ever really capitalized on it, you know, or was it kind of like, yeah, they're cool, and no one bought them. So maybe there was more out there than we thought.
I think the problem was is that, you know, we tend to see stuff on the competitive side, and outside of a few people, I think many had issues really finding that competitive edge to use with them.
It's a good point.
You know, back in 7th edition when they came out, I only can remember it was Jeff Robinson playing them. You know, he's the only person I can actively think of that was playing Gene Steeler Cults competitively back then. I'm sure there were plenty of others, but, you know, I don't remember hearing about any back then.
And maybe it. Well, I definitely think they're going to have quite a bit of tools available to them to make them very competitive. And I think it's also just interesting the way, you know, they're taking what was a pretty thin codex in previous editions. Add a splash, quite a few new units, but really fleshed them out. Wonder if that's part of the direction. We'll talk about that a little bit later, what 2019 will bring to 40K now that all the codices are out. But just curious what direction they'll go in from here. So, but overall, very impressive start. And it's only day one of the previews. We'll see what the rest of the previews are for later in the week. And of course, you can find more updates on our Facebook page if you want to follow along between now and our next episode. So after the break, we did have quite a bit of tournament action just 2 weeks before LVO. We'll go over that right after this.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
Welcome back after the break. We had several tournament action over this past weekend. Get you guys fully up to date. We'll start in jolly old England, in a lovely town that just rolls off the tongue, Earthlingborough, England. I have no idea where this is. If you guys know from the local area, let me know. I have not a clue. But anyway, this is what your top eight looks like. Starting in eighth place with Aldari is Ben Jones. Seventh place is Stephen Box with Death Watch. Stephen Box, that's a cool name. I like that name. It might be my stage name. Sixth place with Jukari, Dan Wright. Fifth place, Kyle Brown with Adeptus Custodes, followed by a tie for third between Jack Spencer and his Imperial Knights and Elliot Hamer with Adeptus Custodes. In second place, we have John Spence with Chaos Demons. Hey, we haven't seen Chaos Demons in the top for a while. But your winner of the War in the Warp 2019 is none other than Simon Pritis with Orcs. So once again, Orcs flexing their muscles since having their codex. Very exciting. See them back on top. Quick event. Want to give a quick shout out to is the Warhammer GT. Wait, what? This was up in Ontario in a town I cannot pronounce. I think it's Mississauga. Apologize if I mispronounced that. They were just short. They're 3 players short of making it officially a GT. So it is actually an RTT. But Archon Scar did take it first place in that one, solidifying himself as the one to be best in faction when it comes to Drukhari. So we'll see how that all unfolds at LVO in 2 weeks. We now go to south of the border, but north of most of us here in the United States, to Fargo, North Dakota, and the Fargo Badlands Open GT. Their top eight looks something like this. Mike Smith coming in 8th place with Thousand Suns, then a tie for 6th place between Ben Cherwin with Death Watch, and Chris Nelson with Imperial Knights. 5th place is David Aramond with Imperial Knights. 4th place, Kyle. There's only one C in his name. Kyle Thompson with Ravenwing. We don't see them too often in the top 8. It's pretty cool. Sean Langenfelder with Imperial Knights comes in 3rd place. Brandon Johnson with Death Guard comes in 2nd. And your winner? Nicholas Weiss with Imperial Knights. Second event in a row, we've seen some Death Watch in the top 8. Nice to see that. And last but not least, our event here close to home. Many of our... Yes, we're very excited about that. The button. The Authoria First Last Chance GT. So some familiar names from the podcast will be appearing in the top 8. So we'll start off in 8th place, Zachary Elgersma with Knight Renegade. That's right. It's Chaos Knights. Ben Jurek, who's been on the show a few times, with his Orcs coming in 7th. Kevin Clow with Ultramarines coming in 6th. John Lozano with Tau Sept coming in 5th. Adam Baker with Imperial Knights coming in 4th. Don Husen with Death Guard coming in 3rd. John Camacho with Gene Stealer Cult. Still playing Index. Don't get too excited. In 2nd place. And your winner is none other than Daniel Alavas with Inari. One more event to shout out to. It's a New Year's Knockout in Shawnee, Kansas. Your winner is none other than Sean Dilly with Jukari. Quick little thing. I'm sure the poor guy had to listen to everybody going Dilly Dilly all day as he congratulating his win. But a quick shout out to friend of the show, Tony Thabeau, with his Inari coming in 9th place, just missing the top 8. But still racking up quite a few points. So glad to see both players in action. Congratulations to all our winners. With 1 week to go before LVO, we're going to talk a little bit about our predictions of what LVO will bring, and as well as the repercussions for the following 2019 ITC season and the future of the hobby as a competitive sport. We'll talk to you a bit right after this.
on a side note, I just want to state I felt a little victory on Saturday when I heard signals from the front line.
What was your little victory? There we go.
Reese just came out straight up and said that this new Admech character looks like Baron Harkonnen. I was like, yeah, I'm not the only one.
I was talking to a buddy of mine who's not a competitive player. You know, he's pure narrative. I mean, they basically role play 40K with armies. And he's kind of talking about it, you know. And it's just kind of joking with him. And that's just saying, like, yeah, you know, everybody wants competitive 40K to be like Magic the Gathering in 6 months. It's not realistic. I mean, you should be thankful at least you're kicking War Machine's butt right now and kind of build from there. But I guess
the problem is I don't, you know, the thing is, I don't think we'll ever see it hit like Magic. Partly I think it's because of how quick a game of Magic is compared to 40K. Mm-hmm. You can have a round of Magic in 90 minutes. Boom, done. Doesn't matter what's going on. You don't get three rounds done in 90 minutes.
That's just three how games, it is. Right? They play best out of three, right?
Yeah, they play best two out of three. You know, there's no dice roll element. You know, slow play is slow play. They, you know, it'll still happen, but you know, because it's they can fit a best out of three. It's just you better not be losing after that first game, otherwise you might as well not just pick all your cards up now. If you're slow playing round two and you lost round one, the only person you're hurting is yourself. There's also the ability to move your deck. It is 1,000 times easier to pick up your deck and move it than it is to pack up your army and move it.
That's true.
That being said, I say all this and I still think this game's better because, you know, partly because of the dice aspect. I can't tell you how many times from when I played Magic that I'd see someone grab a net deck, go to their FNM and just beat face. All they had to do is know how to play the combo, and they just won. In this game, you have to know strategy. You have to know what to hit with what. You can grab, you know, a net list anytime you want in this game. But if you don't have experience with it, you lose. You know, that's what makes this game so much better. But, you know, people are, and unfortunately, I think part of it might have to do with, you know, just the setting and all the work that goes behind the hobby. Some of these competitive people will just feel entitled. You know, they should have all the time in the world to be able to play. They should, you know, this and that.
You know, it's funny, Sean Naden actually brought that up. It's, you know, it's one thing he was very frustrated with is he springs this superb trap on his opponent, and his opponent's like, oh, I guess I got an hour and a half to think my way out of it. Yeah. And no, you don't. So no, I'm okay with the faster play, and I think there's a couple. I think the area where the game needs to speed up is not the actual play. I think it's the setup, the beginning of the game. That's just
You know what? Maybe because you're going to go to LVO, right?
We'll touch on that in a second. There's my boss still has not approved my time off. Exactly.
I was just going to say, you know, it might be a good idea for someone to mention to, you know, Frankie and Reese that, you know, if some, to, if a game doesn't go to, you know, all go through all the rounds, or, you know, at least four of them, the guy who wins, especially if he's not the slow player, that maybe he should get some bonus points. You know? It's just a thought. There's, you know, how hard is it for someone to, or, you know, I get, here's an alternate one. You know, you got that guy who he managed to eke out three more points on his opponent, so now he's slow playing on his final turn. Maybe he manages to eke out that victory.
Well, two things. Back to the Magic the Gathering. The other thing I'm a little worried about is careful what you wish for. Magic the Gathering, X-Wing, another one of Fantasy Flight Games. I can't remember what this, another company. They have professional TOs. So the idea that Don and
Eric... Oh, I won't be... I was just going to say, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing that. Would you?
Well, that's a concern, because then it becomes, you know, that's one of the, you know, these guys are running their event. So the good news is it's like ITC comes to you as opposed to you try to work with the ITC. The bad news is, what if they don't come to town? They think that, you know, your town's too far away, or you don't have enough players to make it worth their time to come.
So here's the thing. What a lot of people see when it comes to Magic is just, you know, they think of the higher things, you know, the GTs that are, you know, they'll be in this state and this state this weekend, and that's it. Right. But there's plenty of smaller events. What they do is it's kind of I want to call it an accreditation program. You go through these things. It's almost like taking a miniature class or a quiz to become, you know, an X level judge, you know, and that first level judge is just for local. It'd be like if you would apply to 40K, it would be the first level judge could only, you know, he can do RTTs and he can help with GTs. You'd have that second level judge who can do GTs or RTTs. And then, you know, like a third level judge that's, you know, majors and down. I think they've got four or five levels for Magic, but that's because your level one judge just does Friday Night Magic, which is a weekly tournament, no big deal. And then it's not until you start getting to level two where they start doing like the local PTQ kind of a thing. So you, in this case, if GW is going to do something like that, which if you consider how tournaments can get, it's not necessarily a bad idea. But I think in this case, what we would see is more likely that it would be through the ITC guys doing this. It would be like, it might be like everything would be done through them. I mean, at this point, they're pretty much working with them anyway, in a sense.
In a sense, yeah.
They've been helping. I know at the very least, from what I understand at the very least, they've been helping with like the
they are the playtest team, that's for sure.
So at that point, they've got that level of trust. And they're working with them when it comes to some of these tournaments now. That's why they're showing up at LVO and they're going to do stuff there. You know, we're seeing what they're doing where, you know, you can get that model going to some of these really large scale tournaments. I don't think we're going to see GW do what Wizard has done and, you know, be in direct control. I think they'd rather, you know, be kind of a secondary thing when it comes to tournaments, and considering how much more complicated it is than Magic when it gets right down to it, it makes sense. You know, a game like Magic, it's a card game. there's less ambiguity. Because, just as an example, it doesn't matter where the cards are laid down.
Oh, really? I thought this was a whole big order of operation nonsense.
There's an order of operations. But when it gets right down to it, you can have the cards down on the table, however you want to do it. You know? It does, in your little section of the table, you can have, you know, your lands wherever you want them. I've seen people put up in closer to the opponent, you know, closer to them. You know, I've seen people put their decks up in the upper left, bottom middle. As long as it's an established idea, as long as the opponent knows where they put everything, everything's fine. It can be wherever they want it. But in Warhammer 40K, every millimeter of placement is important. You know, you move your Chaos Space Marine, and 1 millimeter movement can determine whether or not you're in close combat. GW can't do much in a tournament sense from their headquarters. But, you know, Magic the Gathering, the Wizards right. doesn't have to do much there.
I know a lot of people are clamoring they want Games Workshop to go back to their, you know, make their tournament packet. You know, this is, you know, Infinity does that. War Machine does that. You know, this is our tournament mission pack, kind of like what ITC does. And so I don't get it. You know, why I get some people, I understand it's important because it comes from Games Workshop. Therefore it is official, but I kind of go back to who would I rather hire the job? The guys have been doing it for the last 8 years. The guy who's just falling back into it after a year. You know, if I'm going to rely on a mission pack, I'm going to rely on the guys who run the ITC or Nova over a new team from Games Workshop that's getting back into competitive play.
Right. Well, I want you to think of this. So Wizards, their judges are not their employees at all. The judges are basically volunteers. They are player volunteers. They are, at least in the past, because I don't know about now, they've been given, you know, the occasional promo card. Though they might, if it's at like some sort of a con, from what I understand, they might get the con badges taken care of. But outside of that, they have to fly there on their own dime. They have to get their own rooms. You know, they're paying for it. Wizards doesn't do that. It was always on the judges. So at the end of the day, it was always a game. They always had different formats, and that's something I think ITC would be cool if ITC did, you know, different formats. But at the end of the day, it was just a game as it is.
Well, the two things that I'm trying to rack my brain around is, yeah, there's multiple formats, and some are more accepted than others. Apparently, that's some of the big hubbub right now among the X-Wing players is the new format they just came out with. A lot of players don't like, but that's the one that.
Well, I mean, they got a new edition.
Yeah, and what people were doing is they were taking the old format but using the new edition rules, and then all of a sudden they came out with this new hyperspace format. And then the official response was, well, it's just another format. You can do whatever you want. And then the player's going to respond back, yeah, but all the new prize support is related to hyperspace. So if you're not... Yeah, so it's kind of like they're kind of stuck. Yeah. If you want the goods, you got to play the new format, which isn't much different than what Infinity did. Yeah, they were promoting some, you know, more uses of their dreadnought equivalents. So they came up with all these missions where the dreadnoughts were the center of the mission, and not every faction even has one. So it's like, okay, that's not exactly fun, or competitive, but I guess we'll run with it. I guess where I'm also looking to, as you mentioned, yeah, these levels of judges, it seems like they're almost these roving teams that you hire out that the, you know, game store says, I need to run a tournament. How much do you guys charge? And they run the event for you.
Well, again, I'm going to go back. Judging, Magic judging is a volunteer basis. At no point is there any money involved. You did, if someone was doing a tournament, they, a lot of times a store that would be doing a store that was doing a tournament, like Manaworks, they had one of their guys go through the stuff to become a judge so that they could judge Friday Night Magic. You know, he was the guy who was working there that night anyway. Once it was time for Friday Night Magic, he basically just put on the judge shirt. He was still working, but his main thing was, you know, I'm judging. Here's another thing. You know, you always hear about their tournament, the tournament's prize support, but they only ever did that in their very large tournaments. You know, their PTQs, their big GTs, their big stuff. Anything smaller than that, anything that was held at like a local store, 100% of that stuff, of that price support, would come from the store. When you see, when you do, every time they did Friday Night Magic, the store would supply boosters for the winner. Anytime that there was a price support for a draft format,
so it is a little bit different. The store paid for that. Okay, that's good to know. So curious to see how. Yeah, so it was posted, I can't remember where. The gentleman who said it, I give him credit, not to bring him down, but I thought it was an interesting question. Oh, I know where it was. Salty John has an article on Frontline Gaming, interviews some of the top players. And he was interviewing Stephen Pamprine, who we've talked about a lot, is really coming on strong as an orc player. And one of the things where he was very excited about the state of the game today, but one of his concerns was, what is the state of the game moving forward? Because if you look at it, that the heads of the ITC are also trying to run in a game company, you know, a very large game store, for lack of a better term.
Well, I think I'm going to just say this right now. I think that's why we're not seeing Reese and Frankie judging the LVO. Sure, they prepped for it. They've been doing a crap ton of work on the terrain, but they're not the ones judging. They're not the TOs. I mean, they're the TOs, but they're not the ones. If you're calling for a judge, it's not going to be them.
So the question then becomes, at what point, because obviously the Frontline Gaming needs to grow, needs their attention, and the ITC needs to grow, that needs more time. And how many times have we heard on their own podcast, we don't have time to do X? And right now it's unfortunate they're not getting much time to play games. They're not as, you know, especially the the popular games, you know, like some of the, they used to be able to get a couple games in, even some of the fringe, like you never hear about Drop Fleet Commander anymore, you know, like, or Dropship, whatever it's called. I don't even know the name of it anymore. You know, it's gone. They used to play that game regularly on their stream. They don't even have a chance to play Necromunda. He hasn't even played Kill Team yet. And so you've been to wonder some of these ITC issues. If you had a commissioner who, you know, somebody whose job, I certainly couldn't justify a 40-hour-week job, but they at least had somebody to free up. You know, this is the person who runs the ITC. Or at least be the liaison. I think running it's a tough word, but being that liaison to the TOs, yes, I'm the one who answers all your questions and develops the mission packs and deals with the poll questions and all that.
So just consider, I mean, we've got, 5,000-ish people that are playing, that are just playing the ITC. Never mind.
Right.
Everybody who plays
5,000 active. Just the ITC. I think there are 8,000 registered unique entities, but there's, I forgot how many of them only played one tournament, you know.
The point is that that's potentially a lot for one person. It's potentially a lot for even a small organization. I do hope that in the near future they consider, you know, maybe it's going to have to be on a volunteer basis no matter what. But if they, you know, work together maybe to create like a small group of people that they just decide to be like, I'm going to call them head judges. They are where the buck stops when it comes to the ITC. When a question gets asked that there's no precedent for, there's nothing in the FAQs. And in this case, they would really have to be, they'd have to be on, you know, phone call or email terms with the people who write the rules. Because it's just going to have to be that would just have to be the way it would work. So maybe it would be playtesters that would be considered the head judges that they just feel have the best, you know, the best understanding of the game, the way that GW wants it. And they would have to work together and maybe create like a program where they work with, you know, the lower judges. And then as much as they have to work, they can kind of help delegate some of that stuff out. But their focus would be on, you know, the game packets for the tournament, for a, you know, your basic tournament. And they might be, you know, the first step in trying to determine FAQs, you know, instead of, I mean, sure, there's going to be plenty of going straight to the source. It's always going to happen. But, you know, a lot of times the companies are going to go look at their playtesters anyway and say, hey, how does this play out with you guys? I mean, we see little things like that all the time, especially in the past. Or for the tournaments, they'll have their own FAQ. But with things as they are now, the playtesters, I mean, just from the start, they're going to have a better idea of what's going on, what the intent is. In many cases, I think that intent is getting closer to being what's written on the
page. Well, I think the other big thing was, in the past, it was, we have no idea what the writers had intended. Now it's, hey, it's our monthly phone call. What were you guys thinking with this? Okay, because that's not how it reads. Oh, okay, we can fix that.
Yeah. So, what I really think to really get closer to, you know, what we see with Magic, because for whatever reason, they've become like what you just expect to see for a tournament scene that's doing great, even though I can say this because I used to be a Magic player. I loved the idea of being able to go to GTs and I'd watch them on the weekends. There's plenty of drama that happens there. There's plenty of insanity that happens there. And, you know, Wizards of the Coast has plenty that they have to deal with from it. I saw something today that, now I didn't directly say it, but it sounded like they're cutting back on their coverage. You know, we're talking about some, you know, an organization that for, you know, over a decade would have one or two different games being shown on air at a time, the entire time. From the time they started to afterward, they'd have one or two guys talking, describing what they're seeing. They'd have the occasional interview on air with players. But the thing is they'd sometimes see these matchups and just know that it's not something you can really, show on, show over Twitch or there's whatever they're going to use to stream, because it's going to be a three turn win and it's not going to be.
Well, I think we've learned that also from professional sports, you know, and, you know, they have action in other towns and, when one game gets way out of hand, they'll flip over to the other game. That's a little more exciting. And sometimes here locally, we don't get that privilege because they are obligated to show the hometown to the hometown crowd. So we have to sit there and watch our local team get their head caved in. But, that's been around. It's actually one of the things that the experiment of Monday Night Football, it works and doesn't work. The good news is it's the marquee matchup. It's the opportunity to see a team outside of your local area. You see this key matchup, but they have to make that decision over a year in advance, and things happen. Two of your top three players just got hurt. Things aren't going well, and all of a sudden, by the time November rolls around, that marquee matchup is a little soft, and there's no other game to go to. Whereas on a Sunday, when they've got all 13 games going on at once, they can flip-flop. You know, here's excitement going over here, and more excitement over there, and we'll get back to your game in a minute. You know, that sort of thing. And
yeah. Well, and here's another thing. If we're going to start looking at, you know, professional sports and compare it, you know who's going to play who at a given time. So you can build up momentum around a game of football, of basketball, of baseball. You can't do that in a tournament like this because there's no way to guarantee that you're going to see Nick Nottavati playing Andrew Along, or, you know, this person play that one. It all depends on how
true
he does.
I think the sports you mentioned, you're absolutely right. You have a fixed schedule, and that's who's playing that particular week. And, you know, divisional opponents will always play each other. So that's, but if you look at other sports, specifically like individual sports, like what's like tennis, for example, tennis and Warhammer at first don't have a lot in common, but the idea is that, take your example, Nick Nottavati and Andrew Gagne, will they play each other? Most likely not in the first round or the second round, but by the third round, when both of them are 3-0 and going into day two, you know, it's just, it's amazing how edition after edition, army after army, as they change, the same top 20-ish players are still at the top of the rankings. I think this year has been probably the exception where we've had more diversity in the top 20. But there's still some big names up there that are there year after year. So, yeah, those guys will run into each other after the fact. You know, it may not be round one, but maybe round 4 and 5. NASCAR, which I think equates the closest to 40K if you were looking at it from a professional sports point, because you have the car and you have the driver. So just like you have the player in the list, the cars are comped just like the armies are semi-comped. But the idea is that, okay, you may have, you know, rivalries because this guy didn't like the way the other guy cut him off. And so there's going to be this big drama. And what happens if these rivals match up? They may or may not. Something could go wrong early in the round and early in the tournament. So they don't match up each other or they completely bypass each other. But it builds up a great story and how things all fluctuate out. So, but the key is you need to be able to cover more than one table to do that. And like you said, these people are all volunteers and they're spending their own money on these video cameras and streaming rigs. Those things aren't cheap. No. And while we're on the subject real quick, just a quick shout out, because I think this is one thing that the community as a whole is not talking enough about. There's taking one for the team and there's taking one for the league. Jeff Robinson's going to be shoutcasting at LVO, doing pretty much what he and Frankie did at Nova, and I guess they have some new surprises. But he's pretty much giving up an opportunity not only to win the ITC, but he also pretty much had top custodes player wrapped up, and now that just went up in smoke because he's willing to do this for the community. When with his StarCraft following, that's a high exposure for the league as well as the hobby and the event. So my hat goes off to him. You and I were kind of lamenting about TOs who don't even let players, you know, they give their players buys so make sure the TO can play. This guy's stepping out of an entire tournament. So it's a huge, huge sacrifice. And I don't think it gets talked about enough.
I mean, and it takes a very special mindset and charisma to be able to do something like what him and Frankie are doing. You know, you can't, I couldn't do it. I could not sit there basically behind a table and, you know, shoutcast.
Really?
Around a tournament. I couldn't do it. Partly because I'm not one of those guys who can look at a table and see, you know, what is this person going to do with their striking scorpions? What is that person going to do with that Devastator squad they've got sitting right in that spot? I'm not necessarily going to know that. What's more, I'm not going to know how to build up the excitement in the audience, but you know, Jeff knows how to do that. He's done it for,
he doesn't
want to understand. Starcraft. He does it for a living in a sense.
I would definitely want to give it a shot. I would definitely want to try it.
And if you can, I mean, I wouldn't mind giving it a shot, but I understand that at the end of the day, you put a camera in front of me, I am probably going to puddle up. I can't even stand in front of 10 people and give a PowerPoint presentation without messing up. So the fact that he's going to be doing it in front of a camera, in front of and around hundreds of people, you have to look at that and understand that he knows what he's doing, and he's someone who can do it, and he'll probably do a better job than
true. Well, anyone who's been to any of our tournaments knows you give me a microphone, it's very dangerous. And but to your point, it's one thing; those are very controlled environments. I know exactly what I want to say. I've practiced it, and now I've done like umpteen hundred events at this point. I pretty much got the routine down pat. So, but to be able to be flexible to find out what's going on the table, and let's say creating the storyline, what's going on. And I think that's, the biggest struggle right now with, how does somebody who doesn't know the game watch a stream and know what's going on?
Well, and not only do you have to know what's going on, you kind of have to get in the players' heads. You have to be able to look at it and say, okay, it's this person's turn. It's his shooting phase. What are the moves he should be doing? And the entire time, you also have to be paying attention because you have to know what he's actually doing. And in a game like this, where almost everything's rolling dice, and there may not be any pointing, so you may have to be guessing off of what's being pulled off the table.
Yeah, they talked a lot. That's one of the things I think they're adding this year is a sideline reporter, but not like you see on Monday Night Football where they interview random players, kind of like on Top Chef, Iron Chef. So you've got Alton Brown, who's kind of describing what's going on, but every now and then he's like, "Hey, what's going on? What did he just put in that pot there?" He can't see it. And then there's a reporter there who's asking the actual chefs, "Okay, what's going on here?" So they actually can get closer, more information from table side. And now, of course, the players would have to get used to this constant interjection from the player and from interviews and stuff like that. But at least, as the players are talking to each other, okay, I'm losing four guys to Overwatch. I'm going to remove these players. Okay, he just took, a heavy barrage from Overwatch, and here's what's going on. Okay, thanks, sir. Still in the Overwatch. Figure it out. Okay.
Yeah. In a case like this where, it's going to be a lot of, overhead shots, the person who's standing at the table would basically probably be in direct communication via some sort of audio device like headphones or a micro, things like that. They'd be telling Frankie and Jeff what's going on, and they'll be the ones telling the audience, and it'll probably be short bursts. It'll be things like X unit is shooting at Y unit, and we're moving into the assault phase, things like that. It's top of two, it's right. Bottom of four, things like that. Very short and concise. So
it's just interesting how the sport is kind of growing at this point, and it's kind of a interesting spot, you know, that preface says it could take off, but these are kind of the building blocks of what that will look like moving forward. And I think this year will be a big year to sign, to figure out what that direction will look like. The standardized list, as annoying it is to upload, and I put it fully on me, on pilot error, but there's a couple of us that are just like, yep, attempt number 5, let's try it again. I think once you get it down pat, we'll be fine. But it's such a huge step forward to what's supposed to be on the list, what's not supposed to be on the list. And, you know, you've heard me talk about, you know, people's lists, and I'm trying to read them live on the air here. Some are easier to read. Some of them are, what the heck is this? So, I mean, that's just an easy fix. Now you talk about, okay, how do we bring it to the masses? And yeah, it... whether it be camera angles, you mentioned the overhead shot. I think you need a couple more like miniature levels. I mean, I'd love to see a fog machine on the table too, but that might be a little too much. So what are your thoughts on moving forward, pushing the 40K sport, for lack of a better term, into the common household names and making it more popular? Hit us up on our Facebook page. Let us know what you guys think. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be back with your ITC top 10 and next week. Welcome back. We're going to go over your ITC top 10, and there are 3 distinct groupings within the top 10, and this will make a big impact as we talk about LVO next week in our preview show. But basically, what it breaks down as of this past weekend's action: in 10th place, Joshua Death; 9th place, Brandon Grant; 8th place, Andrew Gagneau; and 7th place, previously in 10th, was Archon Scari. He was able to leap up 4 places there. All of them are hovering at that 105-110 point mark, which means that they're going to have to do some serious work to overtake the front runners for the overall championship. In 6th place, Matt Rutt, as well as Malik Amin Rubio and Trent Northington, as well as Nick Rose, all hanging in there at 70 to 65 points behind the leaders. So again, not quite as much work as the other 4, but they're definitely in the thick of it. And so it would only take one slip up in one early round for our top 2 players to lose their footing on a possible championship. Who would those be? Well, in 2nd place, still Mike Porter, winner of the London GT, and in 1st place, still Nick Nadavati, who's actually confirmed that he will be bringing orcs to LVO to secure what would be his 2nd LVO and ITC championship. But there's still one more weekend to go. Ray, what events do we have coming up this weekend?
Well, as of today, on the Best Coast Pairings website, there is exactly one tournament being held on Saturday. That is the Warpgate 40K 2-day tournament at the Frank D. Salazzo Rec Center in
Harrison, New York. That's a really cool name and a really cool venue, so that's pretty cool. But I think most people will be like me and painting furiously to get everything ready for next weekend. So, like I said, next week we will have our full breakdown of ITC. We'll be predicting our winners and our projected top 8. We have been pretty accurate, not to toot our own horn or anything like that, but last 2 years in a row, we've been able to nail down at least 5 of the top 8 each year. So see if we can keep that streak alive. Until then, my name's Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus podcast.